Fourth iteration. Seven curses. This object is a patriotic funerary plaque in dense white porcelain, of the sort produced to commemorate the deaths of royalty and heads of state. Beneath an originally colourless glaze, cracked and yellowed by processes of time, are visible the features of Lord Byron. Tens of thousands of these objects were sold throughout England during the months following the Prime Minister's death. The plaques themselves were of a standard manufacture, held in readiness for the demise of any sufficiently noted personage. The image of Byron, surrounded by wreaths, ornate scrollwork, and figures representative of the early history of the Industrial Radical Party, has been engine-stippled upon a film of transparent material which was then transferred to the plaque, glazed and fired. To Byron's left, amid stippled scrollwork, a crowned British lion poses rampant above the blurred coils of a defeated serpent, most probably meant to represent the Luddite cause. It was sometimes remarked upon, both during and after Byron's rise to leadership, that his maiden speech in the House of Lords, February 1812, urged clemency for the Luddites. Byron himself, questioned in this regard, is widely believed to have replied, "But there were Luddites, sir, and then there were Luddites." While this remark may be apocryphal, it is wholly in keeping with what is known of the Prime Minister's personality, which would seem to refer to the extraordinary severity with which he later put down and suppressed the popular Manchester-based anti-industrial movement led by Walter Gerrard. For this was a form of Luddism attacking not the old order, but the order that the Rads themselves had established. This object was once the property of Inspector Ebenezer Fraser, of the Bow Street Special Branch. Mallory had stayed with Fraser, watching the police surgeon at work with dirty sponge and bandage until he was sure that Fraser was fully distracted. To further ease Fraser's evident suspicions, Mallory had borrowed a sheet of police stationery and set to the task of composing a letter. In the meantime, the King's Road station had slowly filled with bellowing ruffian drunks and various species of rioter. It was very interesting as a social phenomenon, but Mallory was in no mood to spend the night on a cheerless cot in some raucous cell. His taste was most stubbornly set on something else entirely. So he had politely asked directions of a harried and exhausted sergeant, noted them with care in his field book, and eased out of the station. He'd had no problem finding Cremorne Gardens. The situation there was nicely indicative of the city's crisis dynamic. It was quite calm. No one in the gardens seemed aware of events beyond, the shock waves of localized dissolution having not yet permeated the system. And it did not stink so badly here. The gardens were on the Chelsea Reach, well upstream of the worst of the Thames. There was a faint night breeze off the river, somewhat fishy but not altogether unpleasant, and the fog was broken by the great leafy boughs of Cremorne's ancient elms. The sun had set, and a thousand cloudy gaslights twinkled for the pleasure of the public. Mallory could imagine the pastoral charm of the gardens in happier times. The place had bright geranium beds, plots of well-rolled lawn, pleasant vine-enshrouded kiosks, whimsical plaster follies, and of course the famous Crystal Circle. And the monster platform as well, a great roofed and wall-less ballroom, where thousands might have strolled, or waltzed, or polkered, on the shoe-streaked wooden deck. There were liquor stands inside, and food, and a great horse-cranked pan-melodium playing a medley of selections from favourite operas. There were not, however, thousands present tonight. Perhaps 300 people circulated listlessly, and no more than 100 of these were respectable. This 100 were weary of confinement, Mallory assumed, or courting couples braving all unpleasantness to meet. Of the remainder, 2/3 were men, more or less desperate, and prostitutes, more or less brazen. Mallory had 2 more whiskies at the platform's bar. The whiskey was cheap and smelled peculiar, either tainted by the stink or doctored with hartshorn or potash or quassia, or perhaps Indian berry, for the stuff had the colour of bad stout. The whiskey shots sat in his stomach like a pair of hot coals. There was only a bit of dancing going on, a few couples attempting a self-conscious waltz. Mallory was not much of a dancer at the best of times. He watched the women. A tall, finely shaped young woman danced with an older, bearded gentleman. The fellow was stout and looked gouty in his knees, but the woman stood tall as a dart and danced with as much grace as a professional, the brass heels of her dolly boots glinting in the light. The sway of her petticoats suggested the shape and size of the haunches beneath. No padding or whalebone was there. She'd fine ankles in red stockings, and her skirts were 2 inches higher than propriety allowed. He could not see her face. The panmelodeon struck up another tune, but the stout gentleman seemed winded. The pair of them stopped and moved off among a group of friends. An older, modest-looking woman in a bonnet, two other young girls who looked like dolly mops, and another older gentleman who looked bleak-faced and foreign, from Holland, perhaps, or one of the Germanies. The dancing girl was talking with the others and tossing her head as if laughing. She had fine brunette hair and a bonnet knotted round her throat and hanging down her back. A fine, solid, womanly back and slim waist. Mallory began walking slowly toward them. The girl talked with seeming earnestness to the foreign man, but his face showed reluctance and a seeming disdain. The girl sketched out something like a half-reluctant curtsy, then turned away from him. Mallory saw her face for the first time. She had a strange long jaw, thick eyebrows, and a broad mobile slash of a mouth, lips edged with rouge. It was not exactly an ugly face, but decidedly plain. Yet there was a sharp, reckless look in her grey eyes, and a strangely voluptuous expression that caught him as he stood. And she had a splendid form. He could see it as she walked, rolled, slid almost to the bar. Again those marvellous hips, on the line of that back. She leaned across the bar to chafe with the barman, and her skirt rose behind her almost to her red-stockinged calf. The sight of her muscular leg thrilled him with a jolt of lewd intensity. It was as if she had kicked him with it. Mallory moved to the bar. She was not chafing with the barman, but arguing with him in a half-painful, nagging, womanly way. She was thirsty and had no cash, and said that her friends were paying. The barman didn't believe her, but would not say so straight out. Mallory tapped a shilling on the bar. "Barman, give the lady what she wants." She looked at him with annoyed surprise. Then she recovered herself and smiled, and looked at him through half-shut lashes. "You know what I like best, Nicholas," she told the barman. He brought her a flute of champagne and relieved Mallory of his money. "I love champagne," she told Mallory. "You can dance like a feather when you drink champagne. Do you dance?" "Abominably," Mallory said. "May I go home with you?" She looked him up and down, and the corner of her mouth moved with a wry but voluptuous smirk. "I'll tell you in a moment," and she went to rejoin her friends. Mallory did not wait, for he thought it likely a gull. He walked slowly about the monster promenade and looked at other women, but then he saw the tall, plain-faced girl beckoning. He went to her. "I think I can go with you, but you may not like it," she said.
"Why shouldn't I?" he said. "I like you."
She laughed.
"I don't mean that way. I don't live here in Brompton. I live in Whitechapel."
"That's a long way."
"The trains aren't running, and we can't get a cab at all. I was afraid I would sleep in the park."
"What about your friends?" Mallory asked.
The girl tossed her head as if to say she didn't care for them. Her fine neck showed a bit of machine-made lace at the hollow of her throat.
"I want to go back to Whitechapel. Will you take me? I haven't any money, not a tuppence."
"All right," Mallory said. He offered her his arm. "It's a 5-mile walk, but your legs are a marvel."
She took his elbow and smiled at him.
"We can catch a river steamer at Cremorne Pier."
"Oh," Mallory said. "Down the Thames, eh?"
"It's not very dear."
They walked down the steps of the monster platform into the twinkling, gas-lit darkness.
"You're not from London, are you? A travelling gent?"
Mallory shook his head.
"Will you give me a sovereign if I sleep with you?"
Mallory, surprised at her bluntness, said nothing.
"You can stay all night," she said. "I've a very nice room."
"Yes, that's what I want."
He stumbled a bit on the gravel walk. She steadied him, then boldly met his eyes.
"You're a bit lushed, are you? But you look good-natured. What do they call you?"
"Edward. Ned, mostly."
"That's my name, too," she said. "Harriet Edwards, with an E on the end. My stage name, but my friends call me Hetty."
"You have the figure of a goddess, Hetty. I'm not surprised you're on the stage."
She gave him that bold, grey-eyed look.
"You like wicked girls, Ned? I hope you do, for I'm in a mood to do wicked things tonight."
"I like them fine," Mallory said.
He grabbed her by her tapered waist, thrust one hand against her swelling bosom and kissed her mouth. She gave a little surprised shriek, and then threw her arms around his neck. They kissed a long while beneath the dark bulk of an elm. He felt her tongue against his teeth. She pulled back a bit.
"We have to get home, Ned, all right?"
"All right," he said, breathing hard. "But show me your legs now, please."
She looked up and down the path, then lifted her petticoats to the knee and dropped them again.
"They're perfection," he said. "You could sit to painters."
"I have sat to painters," she said, "and it don't pay."
A steamer sounded at Cremorne Pier. They ran to it and got aboard with moments to spare. The effort sent whiskey racing through Mallory's head. He gave the girl a shilling to pay the fourpence toll and found a canvas steamer chair up near the bow. The little ferry got up steam, its side wheels slapping black water.
"Let's go in the saloon," she said. "There's drink."
"I like to see London."
"I don't think you'll like what you see on this trip."
"I will if you stay with me," he said.
"How you talk, Ned," she said, and laughed. "Funny, I thought you were a copper at first. You looked so stern and solemn. But coppers don't talk like that, drunk or sober."
"You don't like compliments?"
"No, they're sweet, but I like champagne, too."
"In a moment," Mallory said.
He was drunker than he liked to be. He stood and walked to the bow railing and gripped it hard, squeezing sensation back into his fingertips.
"Damned dark in the city," he said.
"Why, it is," she said, standing near him.
She smelled of salt, sweat, and tea rose, and cunt. He wondered if she had much hair there, and what its colour was. He was dying to see it.
"Why is that, Ned?"
"What?"
"Why is it so dark? Is it the fog?"
"Gaslights," he said. "Government have a scheme to turn off the gaslights because they smoke so."
"How clever of them."
"Now people are running about in the blackened streets, smashing everything in sight."
"How do you know that?"
He shrugged.
"You're not a copper."
"No, Hetty."
"I don't like coppers. They're always talking as if they know things you don't know, and they won't tell you how they know it."
"I could tell you," Mallory said. "I should like to tell you, but you wouldn't understand."
"Of course I'd understand, Ned,"
Hetty said in a voice as bright as peeling paint.
"I love to hear clever men talk."
"London is a complex system out of equilibrium. It's like a drunken man, blind drunk, in a room with whiskey bottles. The whiskey is hidden, so he's always walking about looking for it. When he finds a bottle, he takes a long drink, but puts it down and forgets it at once. Then he wanders and looks again, over and over."
"Then he runs out of liquor and has to buy more,"
Hetty said.
"No, he never runs out. There's a demon that tops up the bottles constantly. That's why it is an open, dynamical system. He walks round and round in the room forever, never knowing what his next step may be. All blind and unknowing, he traces circles, figure eights, every figure that a skater might make, but he never leaves the boundaries. And then one day the lights go out, and he instantly runs headlong out of the room and into outer darkness. And anything may happen then, anything at all, for the outer darkness is chaos. It is chaos, Hetty."
"And you like that, eh?"
"What?"
"I don't know what that means that you just said, but I can tell you like it. You like to think about it."
With a gentle, quite natural movement, she put her hand against the front of his trousers.
"Isn't it stiff?"
She snatched her hand back and grinned triumphantly. Mallory looked hastily about the deck. There were other people out, a dozen or so. It seemed none of them were watching, but it was hard to tell in the foggy darkness.
"You tease," he said.
"Pull it out, and you'll see how I tease."
"I'd rather wait for the proper time and place."
"Fancy a man saying that," she said, and laughed.
The steady, slapping paddle wheels suddenly changed their tenor. The Black Thames gave up a vile rush of stench and the crisping sound of bubbles.
"Oh, it's horrid," cried Hetty, clapping a hand to her mouth. "Let's go in the saloon, Ned, please."
A strange curiosity pinned Mallory in place.
"Does it get worse than this? Downriver?"
"Much worse," Hetty said through her fingers. "I've seen folks swoon away."
"Why do the ferries still run, then?"
"They always run," Hetty said,
half turning away.
"They're mailboats."
"Oh," Mallory said. "Can I buy a stamp here?"
"Inside," said Hetty. "And you can buy me something, too."
Hetty lit an oil lamp in the cramped little hallway of her upstairs lodging in Flower and Dean Street. Mallory, powerfully glad to be free of the fog-choked eeriness of Back Street, Whitechapel, edged past her into the parlour. A square, plank-topped table held a messy stack of illustrated tabloids, somehow still delivered despite the stink. In the dimness he could make out fat, engine-printed headlines bemoaning the poor state of the Prime Minister's health. Old Byron was always feigning sickness, some gammy foot or rheumy lung or raddled liver. Hetty entered the parlour with her glowing lamp and faded roses bloomed in the dusty wallpaper. Mallory dropped a gold sovereign on the tabletop. He hated trouble in these matters and always paid in advance. She noted the ring of the coin, smiling. Then she kicked off her street-mudded dolly boots and walked, swaying, to a doorway, which she flung open. A grey cat ran out, mewing, and she fussed at it, petting it and calling it Toby. She let it out to the stairs. Mallory watched her do this and stood flat-footed in unhappy patience.
"Well, then, come on with you," she said, tossing her plaited brown head.
The bedroom was small enough and shabby, with a pressed oak two-poster and a tall, tarnished cheval glass that looked as if it had once cost some money. Hetty set the lamp on the badly delaminated veneer of a bedside commode and began to pick at the buttons of her blouse, pulling her arms from the sleeves and tossing the garment aside as if clothing were more trouble to her than she cared for. Stepping deftly out of her skirt, she began to remove her corset and a stiff, crinkled petticoat.
"You wear no crinoline," Mallory noted hoarsely.
"Don't like 'em."
She popped the waistband of the petticoat and laid it aside. She deftly picked the wire hooks of the corset and eased its laces open, then wriggled it over her hips and stood there, breathing in relief, in her lace chemise. Mallory got out of his jacket and shoes. His member strained at his fly buttons. He was anxious to get it out of his trousers, but didn't care to parade his erect prick by lamplight. Hetty jumped into the bed in her chemise, the worn springs complaining loudly. Mallory sat on the edge of the bed, which smelled powerfully of cheap orange water and Hetty's sweat, and got his trousers and unmentionables off, leaving himself in his shirt. Leaning off the bed, he unbuttoned one compartment of his money belt and removed a French letter.
"I'll do it in armour, dear," he muttered. "Is that all right?"
Hetty sat up brightly on her elbow.
"Let me see it, then."
Mallory showed her the rolled membrane of sheep gut.
"It isn't one of those queer ones," she noted, with apparent relief. "Do as you like, dearie."
Mallory carefully peeled the device over the taut skin of his prick. This was better, Mallory thought, happier for this act of foresight. It felt more as if he knew what he was doing here and that he would be safe after all, and get his money's worth as well. He climbed under the dingy sheet. Hetty wrapped her strong arms around his neck and kissed him fiercely with her great crooked mouth, as if she meant to glue it to him. Mallory, startled, felt her tongue writhing about on his teeth like a slick, warm eel. The strange sensation powerfully stimulated his virility. He struggled atop her, her solid flesh feeling marvellous through the obscenely thin veil of the chemise, and fought with the garment till he had it up about her waist. Hetty made enthusiastic, groaning noises as Mallory groped about in the damp fleece between her legs. Finally, seeming impatient, Hetty reached down without ceremony and jammed his prick into her cunt. She stopped sucking his mouth as they began to rut. Soon they were breathing like steam gurneys, the bed creaking and jouncing beneath them like a badly tuned panmelodium.
"Oh, Ned, darling," she yelped suddenly, setting 8 sharp fingernails into his back. "What a fine big one it is! I'm going to spend!"
And she writhed under him in near convulsion. Jolted by the strangeness of a woman speaking English in the midst of sexual congress, he spent abruptly, as if the seed were wrenched unwilling from his flesh by the hard, lewd plunging of her loins. After a quiet, panting moment, Hetty kissed his bearded cheek with the half-shy, lash-fluttering look of a woman conquered by desire.
"That was fine indeed, Ned. You really do know how to do it. Now let's have something to eat, shall we? I'm bloody starving."
"Good," Mallory said, rolling off the sweaty cradle of her hips. He felt grateful to her, as he always did to any woman who had favoured him, and a bit ashamed of himself and of her as well. But very hungry, too. He had not eaten in many hours.
"We can get a nice petty super downstairs from the Hart. Mrs. Cairns can fetch it up for us. She's my landlady what lives next door."
"Fine," Mallory said.
"You'll have to pay for it, and tip her, though."
Hetty rolled from bed, her chemise rucked up. She tugged it loose, but the glimpse of her magnificent backside sent a wash of gratified amazement through him. She knuckle-thumped the bedroom wall in quick staccato. After a slow moment, there was an answering knock. "Your friend's up late?" Mallory said.
"She's used to this business," Hetty told him, sliding back in bed with a chorus of squeaks. "Never you mind Mrs. Cairns. She mills her poor husband about every Wednesday and keeps the whole building awake."
Mallory carefully removed his French letter, which had stretched out of shape, but not torn, and dropped it into the porte de chambre.
"Shall we open a window? It's damned hot."
"No, don't let in the stink, dearie."
Hetty grinned in the lamplight and scratched herself beneath the sheet.
"Anyway, the windows don't open."
"Why not?"
"The casements are all nailed tight. The girl who used to live here last winter, queer little thing, with a po' face and fine gentry airs, but awful frightened of her enemies. She nailed all the windows shut, I think. They finally got her even so, poor creature."
"How is that, then?" Mallory asked.
"Oh, she never brought her men here, that I ever saw, but finally the coppers came here looking for her specials, if you know what I mean, and they gave me a sharp time of it too, the bastards, as if I knew what she did or who her friends were. I didn't even know her real name. Sybil something. Sybil Jones."
Mallory tugged at his beard.
"What did she do, this Sybil Jones?"
"She had a child by an MP when she was young," Hetty said. "Fellow name of... well, I doubt you want to know. She was a politician's tart who used to sing a bit. Me? I'm a tart who poses. Connaissez-vous pose plastique?"
"No," Mallory noted without surprise that a flea had landed on his bare kneecap. He caught it, then cracked it bloodily between his thumbnails.
"We dress in tight leotards, coloured just like skin, and swan about and let gentlemen gawk at us. Mrs. Winterhalter... you saw her tonight in Cremorne, bossing us about. She's my manageress, as they say. The crowd was dreadful thin tonight, and those Swede diplomats we was with are as tight as a chicken's arse. So it was a bit of luck for me that you showed."
A rapping came at the door of the hall. Hetty rose.
"Donnez-moi 4 shillings," she said.
Mallory gave her some coins, which swiftly vanished as she left. Hetty returned with a dented and chipped japanned tray and displayed a misshapen loaf of bread, a lump of ham, mustard, 4 fried sausages, and a dusty split of warm champagne.